Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. I'm particularly pleased to introduce today's speaker. Having worked with Robert, I know he's someone who gets things done. And this has been shown to good effect recently in his work with Winchester Action on Climate Change, a group he set up a couple of years ago. It seems hardly a week goes by without some mention. Are we not hearing me? Yes, of some mention of a new achievement, yes, we're all right, okay. And today Robert's going to talk to us about someone who has inspired him, Ivan Illich. Robert has worked as a BBC radio producer, editor of Penguin Books, general manager of Tanzania Publishing House in Dar es Salaam, research fellow at the Independent Policy Studies Institute, and chief executive of Southern Arts, the job that brought him to Winchester in 1996. But before we hear from Robert, can we say the prayer at the top of your sheet? God of truth and love, in all ages you have blessed our race with prophetic souls, humble to listen for your truth and bold to share it in love. Make us, we pray, humble in heart to listen to your prophets for our time and brave in love to act on the truth they bring. Amen.
Well, good afternoon. I apologise for my croak, which is seasonal, but I think I'll get through. So, but there may be a few sneezes and splutters on the way. For the last 12 years, I've been sleeping in a library. Sometimes there's only just that fraction of a second between the pleasure of reading and the joy of sleeping. And on one of the upper shelves in our library bedroom, there are 10 books by Ivan Illich, the 10 that are on this end of this row. They were all bought between 1972 and 1983, and until I started preparing this talk, for more than a quarter of a century, I hadn't looked at one of them. Indeed, when I took them down from their shelf a few weeks ago, there was a puff of dust clearly visible. And in the last 2 months, I've added the two books at the end to my collection, and both of those two are based on interviews that Illich did with the Canadian broadcaster and writer David Cayley, and I've drawn heavily on those, I'm pleased to confess. I just want to ask how many people in this audience have read a book by Ivan Illich at any time? And how many people have read a book by Ivan Illich, have read it actually in the last 10 years? Yeah, I think, shall we say, we're all in this together, as the man said last week. And I see this very much as a kind of discovery or rediscovery for many of us of Ivan Illich. Like Vincent Donovan and Leslie Newbegin, who were the subjects of the two previous talks in this series, Illich spent absolutely crucial and long periods of his life in developing countries. Donovan, you'll remember, worked in Tanzania, Newbegin in India for a very long period. Illich spent much of his life in Puerto Rico and Mexico. And what he said about the Catholic Church and about schools and hospitals was written out of his experience in those two countries. I first discovered Illich when I was working in Tanzania, and my parents, very good academic father I had, he sent me out, he obviously thought I should read it, a copy of The Listener for the 16th of December, 1971. I still have it. And the first 5 pages of this were devoted to Ivan Illich, and there he is with his quite big smile and features there on the front page. And I think that was my first real introduction. And I noticed that one of the books down this end I did actually buy in Dar es Salaam. So Illich was born in Vienna in 1926. His family on his mother's side was Jewish, but they converted to Catholicism. His father was a sort of land owner in Dalmatia, off the coast of Yugoslavia. And he once described himself as both a wandering Jew and a Christian pilgrim. I think his life can be divided into 3 main periods. There's the period up until about 1960, when he was really finding his feet among the Puerto Rican community. He first worked with the Puerto Rican community in New York, and then he moved to Puerto Rico as the, I think he was the deputy vice chancellor of the university there. And so that was the first period. And the second period was when he was at his most prolific as a writer in the 1970s, particularly the 1960s and 70s. And that was the period at which he was really developed his reputation as a radical thinker. And then the last period, the last 20 years or so of his life, about which I'll say a bit more later. Illich was a priest who thought that there were too many priests. And after being summoned by the Holy Office in Rome and failing to cooperate with an inquiry into what the authorities called his dangerous doctrinal views, his erroneous ideas about the church and his bizarre conceptions of the priesthood, he left the priesthood in 1969, but he never abandoned his vow of celibacy or his daily reading of the office. Illich, and I think this is what makes him particularly attractive to me, was a fully paid-up member of the awkward squad. He was forever questioning conventional wisdom. He spoke truth to power, I think quite courageously on many occasions. And he was always seeking to develop and elucidate his ideas. But he was also always a man of faith. He was prophetic, I think, in a number of ways. He recognized aspects of the human condition and indeed the effects of social and economic structures to which others were at the time blind. And he described crises and challenges, the full consequences of which have really only been fully realized decades ahead. I think we're realizing them now. It must also be said, though, that on the face of it, and like many prophets, Illich, in what he prophesied, was, I think, often wildly inaccurate. To take one example, in the 1960s, he wrote, "I expect that by the end of this century, what we now call school will be a historical relic, developed in the time of the railroad and the private automobile, and discarded along with them." Well, here we are 40 years later, and schools are being built all over the world. There are new investments in railroads, and one of the most popular programs on television is about the pleasures of driving automobiles as fast as possible. So while this talk isn't a defense of Illich, what I do want to argue is that whatever our own core beliefs or faith, Illich's fearless questioning of established institutions, the constant challenging of conventional wisdom, and his recognition that our industrial society is deeply off course, all these are as relevant as ever, and in many ways even more pertinent than when he was writing. And I just want to highlight a few of his key ideas, first from the 1970s, 60s and 70s, and then from the interviews that he gave to David Cayley in the 1980s and 1990s. He died in 2002. I think the Illich of the 1990s can be seen as an evolution of much of his earlier work, the radical thinker of the 1970s. He didn't renounce his earlier work, but he was forever restless intellectually and spiritually. He was forever moving on in his ideas. So the five books, which are this end of this row, Celebration of Awareness, Deschooling Society, Tools for Conviviality, Energy and Equity, and Medical Nemesis, which is subtitled The Expropriation of Health. These five books, all published in the first half of the 1970s, were the books that made him a sort of global guru. And among the key ideas which recur in these books are firstly the questioning of progress, commonly held views of progress. Secondly, the argument that professions and institutions set up with the best of intentions tend to end up by becoming disabling rather than enabling, and that institutions and technologies tend to go through two watersheds, the first at which they become productive and a second at which they become counterproductive and turn from means into ends in themselves. He always preferred the old English word tools to the Latinate technology. Tools for him included hammers, but also included highways and healthcare systems, as well as technologies more narrowly defined. Illich's questioning of progress began as an analysis of the specific effects of schooling in Puerto Rico and prompted his critique of the whole range of ideas, practices, and institutions implicated in the term development. He noticed how schools in Puerto Rico thwarted the very objective at which they ostensibly aim, equality of opportunity, by monopolizing education and pricing it out of the reach of the majority. And so in deschooling society, he identified schooling as the fundamental ritual of a consumer society. Schola, the Greek word from which ours derives, means leisure. And true learning, according to Illich, can only be true learning can only be the leisured pursuit of free people. The scope of the argument in deschooling society was broader than just the nature of schools. Illich didn't object to the existence of schools so long as they were recognized as privileged enclaves and didn't monopolize public choice. He wanted to help bring about a society founded on a vision of freedom from envy and from addictive dependence on institutions. And this was central to his broader critique of the model of development promoted by the American and other governments. Illich saw development as a war on subsistence that would replace a tolerable absence of goods and services by a much more painful condition, which he named modernized poverty. Development, Illich argued, opens a vista onto an earthly paradise of never-ending consumption, but ends by generating needs that cannot be met and demands for services that can never be delivered. And at the same time, the glamour that attaches to development dulls the dignity of subsistence and disables the pursuit of self-sufficiency. Illich was conscious that schools grade, and in his view, they also degrade large numbers of people. Schooling fosters the illusion that also it fosters the illusion that worthwhile learning depends on teaching. And he argued that there's no intrinsic reason why the education that schools are now failing to provide could not be acquired more successfully in the setting of the family, of work and communal activity, in new kinds of libraries and other centres that would provide the means of learning. And I think we are now beginning to see Illich's influence rather belatedly at work in some of the developments, particularly in secondary schooling, the development of personalised learning with much greater emphasis on collaborative learning and on student leadership. But Illich's criticisms of the medical profession were even fiercer than what he had to say about schooling. Medical nemesis begins with the bald claim that the medical establishment has become a major threat to health. The book explores the various ways in which the dominance of the medical profession disables its patients by undoing their courage and their capacity to heal, to suffer, and to die. Clinical iatrogenesis, the harms and conditions originating with the doctor, are these days much discussed and indeed understood. And only a couple of weeks ago, I saw a half-page advertisement in a weekly magazine for a society called SIN, which stands for Sufferers of Iatrogenic Neglect. And it claims that 30,000 people die needlessly in UK hospitals and 40,000 are seriously injured. Now, obviously, there's been a huge amount of debate and continues to be over that that aspect of the health service in recent years. But what Illich was particularly concerned to draw attention to in the latter part of his life was social and particularly cultural iatrogenesis. The fact, as he saw it, that people obsessively pursue medically defined images of health and increasingly believe that it is themselves that they are seeing in the distorting mirror of medical monitoring and screening and risk assessment. He wrote in Medical Nemesis that medical civilization tries to abolish the need for an art of suffering and produces a progressive flattening out of personal virtuous performance. Modern medicine, Illich argued, saps the will of people to suffer their reality. So he warned against the dangers of the physician being put in charge of life from sperm to worm, as he put it. He argued that unrestrained medical treatment deprives suffering and death of their meaning and undermines the cultural traditions that once allowed people to face them with dignity. It is therefore relevant to say that although he, despite all this, was not actually a fundamentalist about medicine, when a malignant tumour appeared on the side of his face about 20 years before he died, he sought no orthodox medical treatment and controlled it as best he could through acupuncture and by smoking opium. Once, when he was travelling by plane, an oncologist was by chance seated next to him and began to palpate the tumour without Illich's permission. It was as if, Illich joked subsequently, that he'd come within the doctor's jurisdiction merely by appearing in public with an untreated condition. In the 1970s, Illich pointed out that effective health care depends on self-care, but by the end of his life, he'd radically revised even that view. By the 1990s, responsibility for health had become, for him, what he called a rain dance, a way of warding off evil that at the same time domesticates it. In both Energy and Equity and Tools for Conviviality, Illich anticipated the unprecedented, I think, environmental crisis in which we now find ourselves. It is part of the reality of the 21st century that reducing carbon emissions from transport is one of the toughest nuts to crack in trying to meet the challenge of climate change. But 35 years ago, long before there was any serious public discussion of global warming, Illich argued that high speed is the critical factor which makes transportation socially destructive. A true choice among political systems and of desirable social relations is only possible where speed is restrained. Participatory democracy demands low energy technology, and free people must travel the road to productive social relations at the speed of the bicycle. That's from Energy and Equity, in which he also pointed out that if you factor in all the time that Americans spend every year on earning the money to pay for their car and to maintain it, quote, the model American each year puts in 1,600 hours to get 7,500 miles, less than 5 miles per hour. The more people use cars, the less useful cars become. Up to a certain speed and density, automobiles may expand mobility, but beyond this threshold, society becomes their prisoner. And he goes on to say that just as the demand for better health at all costs is a form of mental sickness, so is the pretense of higher speed. And no doubt he had the contrast between the bicycle and the car partly in mind when he wrote in Tools for Conviviality, "Tools foster conviviality to the extent to which they can be easily used by anybody, as often or as seldom as desired, for the accomplishment of a purpose chosen by the user. The use of such tools by one person does not restrain another from using them equally. They do not require previous certification of the user. Their existence does not impose any obligation to use them. They allow the user to express his meaning in action." The idea that Illich urgently wanted to establish in his books of the 1970s was that many contemporary institutions had reached and were rapidly surpassing a threshold at which they would turn malignant and counterproductive. Beyond a certain size and intensity, he argued in Tools for Conviviality, institutions begin to generate as many problems as they promise to solve. Illich was a scholar. He was principally a historian. And he observed the roots of the way institutions lose the purpose for which they were set up in the institutionalization of charity in the 13th century church. Indeed, the church was, for Illich, the prototype of all subsequent service bureaucracies. Well, now, that's a rather kind of rapid tour of some of Illich's main ideas in the 1970s and 1960s, but it's worth noting that these countercultural ideas were first expressed by Illich in the 1960s, but greatly expanded on in the books and pamphlets in the 1970s. In 1983, he published a book called Gender, which is essentially a work of history, but it was also a powerful critique of feminism, in that he argued that the feminist pursuit of equality would produce new privileges for a minority of women and new disadvantages for the majority. You can imagine how that went down in feminist circles in North America and Europe. And I think to do justice to that book would need a talk on its own, and I'm certainly not qualified to do it. But most of the reviews were hostile. Illich was sharply attacked by feminists and others for being both a reactionary and a romantic. And it really marked the end of the period in which Illich was in great demand as a sort of charismatic lecturer and teacher. Illich's work in the 1960s and 1970s was a call to institutional revolution. As David Cayley put it, he outlined the marriage of playfulness, austerity, and the sense of scale that he felt would be necessary to counteract the prevailing technomania and institutional hubris. But Illich's hopes in the 60s and 70s were not realized, and we're still faced with the fact that we have the technology of the gods and the politics of children. And this brings me to a consideration of ideas to which Illich gave particular emphasis in the last period of his life, a period in which he was often in acute physical pain. His books were no longer published by mainstream publishers. He earned his living in the margins of a number of universities, but he did manage to persuade the US Inland Revenue that a certain number of cases of ordinary but decent wine were his major teaching tool and could therefore be written off from taxes. I don't think that would have passed muster with Sir Thomas Legg somehow. From the start of his priesthood, Illich had distinguished two forms of the church, which he called the church as she and the church as it. To the first, the church as the repository of tradition and the living embodiment of Christian community, he was and always remained deeply committed. The church in this sense, he said, is that surprise in the net, the pearl, the mystery, the kingdom among us. But to the second, the church as a self-serving worldly power, he was always a pretty sharp thorn. Illich regarded the modern West as a perversion, indeed a betrayal, of Christian faith. He frequently cited the old Latin phrase, corruptio optimi qui est pessima. The corruption of the best is the worst. Or in other words, the depth to which we have fallen the depth to which we have fallen is the measure of the height to which we were called. For Illich, the church became less and less capable of discerning its own tendency to substitute power for faith, and more bent on a comprehensive regulation of Christian life. And what began in the church was gradually built into the unconscious foundations, the certainties, as Illich says, of the modern world. So he criticized the church for its inability to recognize the crucial difference between charity, always an individual vocation, a personal call, the charity of the Good Samaritan, and its institutional counterfeits. At the same time, he was a realist about institutionalization as such. He recognized that people are not angels and can't live without institutional routine. He regarded the institutionalization of charity, if not as an inevitable process, then at least as an entirely and understandably human one. In the book at the end of this row, created from interviews with David Cayley, The Rivers North of the Future, which was published posthumously in Canada in 2005, Illich elucidates on this central idea of his that the modern West is a betrayal of Christian faith. He also expands on his view that since the 1980s, society has been incorporated into a world of systems, that the computer had replaced the book as the root metaphor of the age, and that the moment of collective decision-making may have passed. This gives a new emphasis to what I take to be a mainstream Christian belief in our radical powerlessness. But no less importantly, he argues that for him, friendship has been the source, condition, and context for the possible coming about of commitment and like-mindedness. In effect, the search for truth depends on the cultivation of an open group of people who are moved by fidelity to each other as persons and dare to maintain fidelity even if the other one becomes a heavy burden. So just to recap on these three of Illich's ideas that he developed partly through his life but particularly towards the end of his life, and I hope I'm not caricaturing them. To summarise, the institutionalising of charity has inadvertently resulted in a betrayal of Christian faith. Secondly, in the last 30 years, we've been through a terrifying change, the incorporation of our lives into a world of systems that cannot effectively be controlled. But that thirdly, friendship is a precondition for the search for truth, and the search for truth must continue even while recognising our radical powerlessness. I want to end with a brief reflection on Ivan Illich and human-caused climate change. In the 1970s, Illich was acutely aware of environmental degradation and was one of the first, effectively, to point out that energy policy should not be separated from social justice. Energy and equity go together. In 1990, he'd become genuinely horrified at the contemporary world. In a lecture in Hanover in that year, he said, "I can imagine no complex of controls capable of saving us from the flood of poisons, radiations, goods and services which sicken humans and animals more than ever before. There's no way out of this world. I live in a manufactured reality ever further removed from creation, and I know today what that signifies, what horror threatens each of us. A few decades ago, I did not yet know it. At that time, it seemed possible that I could share responsibility for the remaking of this manufactured world. Today, I finally know what powerlessness is. Responsibility is now an illusion." Well, my own view, for what it's worth, is that I believe that Illich is too depressed and too negative at this point. I personally don't believe that responsibility is an illusion. And last night in Southwark Cathedral, I wasn't there, but I've read part of the text, Rowan Williams told his audience that people should use the climate change crisis as an opportunity to become human again, setting aside the addictive and self-destructive behavior that has damaged our souls. This is what the Archbishop of Canterbury said. "Many of the things which have moved us towards ecological disaster have been distortions of who and what we are, and their overall effect has been to isolate us from the reality we are part of. Our response to this crisis needs to be, in the most basic sense, a reality check." And Rowan Williams added, "We need to keep up pressure on national governments. There are questions only they can answer about the investment of national resources. But we need equally to keep up pressure on ourselves and to learn how to work better as civic agents." Climate change is an urgent issue, and Illich would have categorized it as an evil, not a problem. To quote him again, he says, "We can suffer such evil. We can be broken by it, but we cannot make sense of it, cannot direct it." However, as somebody who always tried to think and to live his Christian faith in the thick of modern ideas and institutions, I wonder how he would have responded to Rowan Williams' lecture and to the statement recently published by the Religious Society of Friends, the Quakers, who say that the crisis of global climate change represents a supreme test of humanity's collective wisdom and courage. I imagine that Illich would have warned us against succumbing to what he called rain dances, trying to ward off evil while at the same time trying to domesticate it. But he did leave us with some positive guidance. Having lived a life of relentless questioning and intellectual curiosity, and having stressed the importance of tools for conviviality, Illich suggested at the end of his life that the best way to live our lives was through courageous, disciplined, and critical renunciation accomplished in community. So I'm very pleased to have had this opportunity to rediscover Illich and rediscover him with you. Most of these books are actually still in print, and most, I'm glad to say, are on the side of brevity. In one of his interviews, he said, "I have no expectations from technology, but I believe in the beauty, in the creativity, in the surprising inventiveness of people, and I continue to hope in them. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert, for reminding us so comprehensively of what Ivan Illich had to say, and also for your own reflections on that. Please join us for sandwiches downstairs. Robert is staying on, so if you wanted to ask him any questions, I'm sure he'd be very happy to prolong the discussion. Next week, David Holgate will be talking on Alan Paton, the South African writer and politician. And it says here, he was novelist and pre-apartheid prophet of racial injustice. We shall be producing CDs of all the talks. Are there forms yet? There are forms, yes. Graham is holding them up. There are forms at the back of the church if you want to sign up for CDs. There is a bookstall downstairs. I believe there is one book by Ivan Illich. Oh, Mandy is rushing down there now. But there are books by Vincent Donovan and Leslie Newbigin, our two previous prophets. And I think the last thing I have to say, as usual, is to ask you for your donations. We do rely on donations. Although Robert walked here, I'm sure, some of our speakers have to come from further afield, and we rely on your donations for their expenses. So thank you very much. Thank you.